Section 2. Living Through Transition and Diagnosis. Chapter 6. Transition and Learning to Read Who I Wanted to Be. By the time I was in my early 20s, my life as Laura was starting to take proper shape. I was working full-time under a female name, with female gender markers on my ID, and presenting as female in every area of my life. I was on hormones, I was speaking to a therapist, I was out to the world, and I was starting to live a new life where I could be more direct and open about how I wanted to be perceived. The problem was, I kind of sucked at getting the world to read me as a woman. By the time I started medical transition, taking both hormone blockers to halt testosterone puberty worsening, and taking estrogen to start feminizing some aspects of myself, the bulk of first puberty's damage had already been done. I had dark, coarse facial hair growth on my face and neck. I had a ludicrously large Adam's apple. My shoe size was too large for shopping in most women's sections without cramming them into shoes several sizes too small for me. And most of my bones were pretty much set in size for good. I had relatively broad shoulders, narrow hips, a slightly square face, and was over 6 foot tall. These are all pretty common aspects of testosterone-based puberty, and none of these are things that can be altered without surgery once they've had time to happen in the first place. It's an issue any trans woman who transitions after their first puberty has completed has to live with and learn to handle. When it comes to getting your penis inverted and crafted into a vagina, the NHS generally consider that a necessary treatment for trans women. At least when I was going through the NHS, pretty much everything else was considered an optional cosmetic procedure, and as a result, not covered by NHS funding. If you wanted facial feminization surgery to smooth out your face, or a tracheal shave to reduce your Adam's apple's prominence, you needed to pay for those out of your own pocket, and they don't come cheap. On top of this, things like facial hair growth and voice changes are not affected by hormones, at least for trans women. Getting on hormones doesn't make your facial hair stop growing entirely, nor does it reduce the depth of your voice. Testosterone is a pretty tricky hormone to deal with, as the changes it makes are more or less permanent and not open to later hormone alteration. Trans men can start taking testosterone and find that their facial hair starts to grow and their body shape changes, but starting estrogen won't convince your body to undeepen your voice or thin out that facial fuzz. You might get lucky like me and find hormone replacement therapy makes some of your body hair lighter and less noticeable, but that's about it for undoing the changes made by a testosterone-based puberty. The bigger problem comes into play when you're a trans woman who also suffers with autism, because a lot of the techniques other trans women use in order to present more femininely come with their own set of challenges that can make them inaccessible to women like myself. My eternal battle with makeup. Let's start with makeup, because it's the bane of my personal existence. I undeniably look more traditionally feminine and experience less anxiety and dysphoria over my appearance when I wear well-applied makeup. I can use a good foundation to cover up my stubble and mask its appearance. I can use mascara and eyeliner to draw attention to my eyes. And I can use lipstick to make my lips appear fuller. Contouring can help disguise the shape of my face, and I have a far lower rate of being misgendered when wearing well-applied makeup. There are, however, two major problems when it comes to me wearing makeup: the texture on my skin, and the difficulty applying it to my own face. So, let's start with the texture issue. I frequently have to deal with touch-based oversensitivity, and unless I'm having a rare day of relief from those symptoms, I tend to find that actually wearing makeup takes a lot of my mental resources. All I want to do the whole time I'm wearing makeup is wipe it off, wash it off, retouch it, perfect it, get it off, touch it to assure myself things are okay, not to touch it, to not get fixated on it, and generally think too much about the abnormal feeling that's clinging to my face skin. Then there's actually applying makeup. Like many people on the autism spectrum, I suffer from a multitude of coordination issues. Apparently, it's because a key part of coordinating oneself relies on processing visual information accurately in order to process and predict where your body is, then accurately make small movements adjusting for that information. If you've got a brain that's oversensitive to visual information, and as such constantly trying to process too much information, unsure of which bits to focus on and which to filter out, it's going to affect your ability to accurately adjust to that information. In short, too much information in via the eyes means understanding how to make specific movements is harder. I struggle with both small-scale and large-scale motor control, meaning I'm frequently clumsy, as well as struggle to do detailed tasks like tying my shoes, holding small objects, and applying makeup to my face. I don't have the coordination to apply different levels of pressure when applying foundation, meaning I struggle to blend and soften the edges, and end up with horribly visible lines around the edge of my face. I can't apply eyeliner evenly or without poking myself repeatedly in the eyes. I spent years when I first transitioned practicing my makeup on a daily basis, but no matter how hard I tried, I just couldn't make my hands do the small, subtle movements I needed them to do. Comfortable clothing is hard to find. As someone who has a lot of issues with touch-based oversensitivity, finding clothing that works for my body can at times be a challenge. As an autistic adult, I find I have a lot of difficulty with tight, form-fitting clothes or outfits that feature multiple different types of fabrics. I find that I'm oversensitive to a lot of aspects of fabrics and how they fit with my body. It's a big enough area of conflict in my life today that it inspired the name of this book. I struggle with clothing tags, which are made of different material to the clothing they're fitted into and stick out at odd angles, flapping around unpredictability and poking into me, dragging uncomfortably and taking up all my attention, trying to manage. Tight-fitting sections of clothing feel like they're cutting into my skin and cause a conflict where some of my skin has predictable constants, but some areas do not. Thick necklines feel heavy on my skin. Certain materials feel like their fibres are scratching me like 1,000 tiny thorns. Some clothing is too flowy and wafty, unpredictable in where it will sit. Some shoulder straps are too prone to falling or shifting. Some clothing rests on the wrong areas and sets off my organisational tidying obsessions. Simply put, clothing as a person with an autism spectrum condition can be really tough to manage. While the fact that clothing tags, textures, and fit styles can cause problems for individuals on the autism spectrum likely doesn't come as a huge surprise to many of you, what is rarely talked about is how that texture sensitivity issue with clothing intersects with learning to manage a new clothing wardrobe after coming out as a trans woman. So here's the deal. When you come out as transgender, one very common issue that comes up is having to very quickly and self-sufficiently develop a new clothing wardrobe from scratch. I had spent probably 16 or more years building a wardrobe and having one built for me by my parents that emphasised traditional masculine traits and presented me to the world as male. Every item of clothing I had was sort of selected towards that aim, and it's not until you decide you want to throw out your wardrobe and start over that you realise how Herculean a task that is. First, most people don't develop a wardrobe all at once. They do so item by item over the years, getting together multiple outfits so you don't appear to only own the one set of clothing, enough to cover all occasions that come up, and enough items that you can, for example, fit a dress code if needed. Doing that is an expensive proposition for anyone, but it comes with a bunch of additionally complicating factors when you're trans. I didn't know what clothing size I was, I didn't know what style suited me, I didn't know what cuts and fits were flattering, or which clothing items I would buy would pair with others I had at home, I didn't know the terms to describe items I was looking for, and I didn't know if there were stores that would accommodate my unique body proportions. I was also in early transition, utterly terrified of the thought of going into a shop and trying on female-coded clothing. A lot of this was because of imagined issues. If I went into a shop and bought something without trying it on, I worried someone serving me would somehow know I was trans rather than simply assuming I was shopping for a partner or a friend. Part of that fear, however, was based in real negative experiences I had when first trying to shop for clothes. Very early in transition, I remember visiting a UK outlet store chain that has brand name clothing that's no longer sold in the stores that originally produced them, as well as cheap off-brand items. I went to the changing area, dressed in a skirt and top, and asked to try on a series of very clearly feminine-coded items. The store staff told me to head into the men's, to which I responded saying I was female. They told me that the men's changing room was the one I would be required to use, so I reluctantly and defeatedly did. The doors in the men's changing room basically only covered neck to knees, so I had to get changed into a dress while a man stood opposite could very clearly see I was changing into female-coded clothing in the men's room. I quickly changed my mind, put my clothes back on and ran out. This early encounter put me off actually trying clothes on before buying them for a long time, which is a big part of why I bought so many of the wrong clothes early in transition. I ended up buying a lot of clothing that was ill-fitting, the wrong size, or simply looked ridiculous on me in practice. It was an exercise in time and money that I could scarcely afford at the time. Part of the issue is that as a trans adult, you're somewhat learning what works for you in a vacuum, without parental support or the support of your peers to help guide you through the process. For most young girls, their parents are able to pass on knowledge and expertise about what might look good on them. Most early outfits are selected by parents, which allows the child to get a sense for matching outfits picked for them. Then, when it's time to start experimenting with clothing themselves, picking out their own outfits, they're generally young enough that they can do that experimentation without fear of judgment. They can pick a pretty dress that doesn't really go with that hat they want to wear, and it's not a problem that they gave the combination a try. As a transgender adult, I had to go through that period of experimentation by myself, largely unaided. And I wore some truly trashy outfits that would have looked more at home on an adult more than twice my age, or considerably younger than myself. I wore outfits that were not flattering in the slightest, and had to do so publicly to learn what worked. I also lacked the ability to really go through that period of experimentation with my peers. Most of the women I was friends with during my transition had sort of found their clothing style a decade or so before. And many of them were afraid to be too critical of my clothing style, for fear of being seen as not encouraging me in my attempts. This led to me not getting proper feedback on my outfit choices, which slowed down the process of finding suitable clothes considerably. Basically, when your supportive female friends won't tell you that your outfits look anything other than cute, you don't really learn what works for you. However, the biggest issue as a transgender woman on the autism spectrum when finding clothing was walking the line between being feminine-coded in presentation and finding clothes that didn't set off my sensory issues. As a trans woman who transitioned post-puberty, I often have an uphill climb to be read as female by people around me, and I find the more I wear clothing that accentuates my body shape, the more often I'm read as female. The maths is simple. If I wear more items that are traditionally coded as feminine, fewer people refer to me as him, he, or sir, and I avoid the dysphoria that comes along with that misgendering. Pair that with the fact that I think I just generally look nice dressed that way, and the choice seems obvious. The problem is, a lot of the clothing that I like wearing for those reasons plays havoc with that bit of my brain that stresses out over tactile sensory inputs. The first time I wore a bra, stuffed with basically two silicone chicken fillet style mastectomy breast forms in order to make a dress I wanted to wear sit on me correctly, I had to deal with a whole host of new sensations I'd never experienced before, as the bra straps and clasp, which press tight against the skin and can at times feel like they're physically cutting into me, even when they're loose and properly fitted enough to not leave huge indentations in my skin. The breast forms added weight on my chest that shifted in ways I couldn't control, and in the summer heat I sweated enough to cause me a great deal of discomfort. I started wearing scarves to hide my Adam's apple, but the way they gradually shifted and rotated through the day made them a constant mental drain, something I had to keep checking on and fixating throughout the day. Tights riding down and not sitting correctly was a distraction that was impossible to ignore, as were strappy tops where the straps shifted around. Clothing suddenly was made of new fabrics and had differing necklines and different cuts. I had 100 new types of sensory information to process, and it was a lot for me to take in all at once. For the longest time, my solution to this issue was to basically flip-flop my appearance, depending on how difficult I felt the situation I was likely to be in was, and how many people were likely to see me and make assumptions about my gender. If I was working from home or going out to the shops, I'd wear comfy clothing that I knew inside out, sometimes wearing the same tracksuit trousers, shirt and baggy hoodie for days at a time. I'd focus near exclusively on wearing clothing that worked with my sensory symptoms, assume that I would be misgendered as a result and brace myself accordingly. Then, if someone was going to see me who I wanted to specifically gender me correctly, I'd wear feminine-coded clothing, putting my comfort completely aside in exchange for a better shot at correct gender reading. While this flip-flopping took up several years of my life, I eventually found a few compromises which have made finding a middle ground between those two far easier. Through practice, trial and error, I eventually learned some materials and styles of shirts and trousers that managed to feminine code me while still working with my sensory issues. I can now wear female cut t-shirts and harem trousers together, remaining comfortable without removing my feminine coding. One of the best discoveries I made that helped me combat this problem was the prevalence in recent years of cheaply available female-coded stimming jewellery. Now, most days when I go out, I accessorise my outfit with a stimming ring, which helps feminine code me while still allowing me something to sit and fiddle with if I'm getting overwhelmed by the rest of my outfit. I wear a bracelet that I can chew on and another bracelet that I can twist and twirl and rotate, both of which are coded in pinks, purples and blues that seem to help me being read as female, even when the rest of my outfit is a bit baggy and shapeless. By combining feminine coding with autism stimming utility, these accessories have been a lifesaver for me on days when I want to avoid misgendering, but also only feel up to wearing a baggy shirt and leggings. As a counterpart to the discovery of stim jewellery accessories was the discovery of clothing specifically targeted at autism, which in many places allowed me to engage with items I could normally not find versions of that worked for me. From seamless socks, which avoid irritating shifting in my shoes, to women's fit t-shirts made without tags or seams present from the start, realising there were options I could add to my wardrobe rotation for days I found tough was deeply rewarding. Bralettes don't feature fastenings and can be found without tags and create an area of constant and gentle pressure without pushing uncomfortably on certain lines of my chest. Their material's consistent and predictable, and it's a solution that's fast becoming a much-needed lifeline in my sensory world. Until the day the world designs autism-friendly bras with reduced seams, wider bands, correctly textured fabrics, and even pressure, this is probably the closest I'm going to find to a workable option. Post-lower surgery, without a pesky penis complicating things, I can now make use of seamless compression underwear, which sit reliably in position and don't have seams moving around all the time, and provide calming, predictable sensory information in much the same way weighted blankets do. Leggings post-lower surgery give me a clothing option that stays in place, doesn't move around, and is made out of materials that don't conflict with my sensory issues, and highlights that my crotch is flat, helping to further improve my odds of being read as female at a glance. Finding smells that calm my senses, like the scent of cinnamon or lavender, was also incredibly helpful for getting used to uncomfortable clothing. I found scented sprays in both fragrances and, for a few years, would heavily douse new clothing in those smells, then let them air out a little before wearing them for the first time. While people must have thought me a little odd for showing up smelling strongly of spices or like a floral air freshener, it helped me to have a positive, calming sensory experience, timed to an item of clothing, while I got used to the unique tactile experience of that item. These are the kinds of discoveries that ultimately helped me to begin managing walking the line between autism-friendly clothing and female-coded clothing. Finding items specifically designed to suit autistic women, and finding stimming items that are female-coded, paired with simple practice and repetition with clothing styles I'd found uncomfortable previously. It took me several years, but I'm already far more at ease balancing these than I was maybe 4 years ago. I just wish I'd had some tailored advice on how to get there a bit sooner than I did. There's this sort of fear instilled in trans women from when our transition begins that if we don't dive headfirst into femininity of appearance, we'll suffer as a result. This belief is instilled in many of us early on in transition when starting to seek early medical support. I remember hearing horror stories of trans women going to the gender identity clinic in jeans and a hoodie, an outfit combo many cis women would regularly wear, and being told that, because of the way they were dressed, the doctor didn't believe that they were sincere in feeling dysphoric. As shocking as those kinds of stories are inherently to hear, they did line up with some of my own lived experience. If I was going somewhere and wanted to be taken seriously as a woman, I had to show up in a blouse, a skirt, a cardigan. Where mainstream feminism has spent the last few decades fighting for the right of cis women to wear anything they like and not be seen as less female for it, with regards to trans women, if we're not wearing a dress, we're not seen as trying hard enough to be female, or we don't want it enough, and it's seen as carte blanche for harassment and hassle. Equally, if we do wear dresses and skirts, we're accused of performative femininity, of believing female identity is nothing more than a dress or skirt being worn. It's a little bit of a nasty double-edged sword trans women have to live with. Learning to walk that line took me several years. I quite like butch lesbian aesthetics, but learning how close to that line I could walk without just being read as male was a considerable task. It made me afraid to wear clothing that worked comfortably with my touch sensitivity for the longest time. Learning to read subtly coded mannerisms. As a woman living with autism, I really struggle with reading small non-verbal aspects of communication. It's not that I can't see a smile or a frown, it's just that noticing a small upturn at the sides of the mouth in the static of all the other sensory information bombarding me day to day takes a lot of energy and focus. What this meant for me was that all of those little differences in the way that men and women traditionally tend to hold themselves, walk, sit, differences in vocal intonation, differences in vocal pacing, were very hard for me to pick up on and learn to emulate. Most people learn these little micro-gestures naturally over the course of their lives, and trying to force yourself to learn them is tough for anyone, but with an autism spectrum condition it can be an even greater challenge. What this all meant, when added together, was that while I was feeling better about my gender identity as a result of transitioning, I found presenting myself femininely took a great deal of mental effort, often caused me distress with my autism symptoms, and initially revolved around a great deal of deliberate actions taken in an attempt to blend in. With regards to my voice, I never got formal vocal training. The way I learnt to change my voice, as well as improve the feminine qualities of my voice, was by recording and editing my own podcasts. I would record myself talking with friends for an hour, then spend the next day editing the audio, listening intently to my speech, while reading an online list of feminine vocal traits. I would listen to sentences I'd said over and over, in isolation, asking myself if I was raising my tone in the right places, if my voice sounded natural or strained, if I was raising and lowering my pitch as I spoke or staying monotone. I would listen to my voice and read a checklist and try to assess in an analytical, isolated context whether my voice sounded feminine enough. I did this 3 times a week, every week, until over time I just sort of picked things up. While changing my vocal mannerisms was initially a huge amount of consistent effort, years later it has become my new normal. I now have to make a concerted effort
to make my voice sound anything like it used to.
In terms of the non-speaking mannerisms, I found these a lot harder to learn. I ended up spending a lot of time watching videos on YouTube of people animating female character models for video games. The looping nature of the animations meant I could just try and soak in the mannerism as much as possible, and it avoided the issue of people watching out in the wild and having someone get aggressive at me for staring at them. But, in the end, over the course of a few years, I found a method that worked even better for me. I tried just not giving a shit. In early transition, I actively pushed for femme presentation all the time, with all the mental drain that came with it. This was partly to combat my feelings of dysphoria, and partly because I had heard horror stories of the NHS refusing to treat trans patients if they didn't present as an exaggerated caricature of their target gender. Over time, I started to think, you know what? Women are allowed to wear tracksuit bottoms and baggy hoodies. They might not emphasise my femininity, but some days I'll take that hit for autism comfort. Similarly, there are days my skin feels too sensitive to shave, and honestly, I just don't. Body and facial hair happens in cis women too, and if nobody important's going to see my face today, it's okay not to worry about it. This no longer caring attitude is what carried me through the later months and years when my sensory issues flared up. I knew I could get away with leaving some traditionally feminine aspects of myself to one side if I needed to just be comfy and not anxious about the sensory inputs on the body. That road, however, took a long time because my autism-specific needs and my needs as a trans woman were so clearly in direct conflict with each other. Learning to be one of the gals. Back when I still intended to hide the fact I was trans in early transition, it always became awkward any time conversations about my childhood arose, as I had to, on the fly, tweak and rewrite history to better fit the version I wanted the world to see. I remember once in early transition, working in a retail store, having a customer sort of half-recognise me and ask if I had a brother who used to work at the store. While it was clear that they'd mistaken pre- and post-transition me as two separate people, I spun them some nonsense story about how my brother had moved to London and wouldn't be working there anymore. These are the sort of lies I told here and there to make sense of my dropping into life as a woman out of nowhere as a young adult. I found myself forcing myself to laugh along at things I didn't understand. I had to dodge my way around direct questions, and it was all just a bit of a rough time. Thankfully, I found a really great group of female friends through costume design in my late teens and early 20s, and they were not only aware I was trans, but willing to bend over backwards to accommodate helping me feel at home. They didn't treat my lack of going through periods as a teen as something that made me less of a woman. They didn't judge me for not knowing sleepover etiquette. They just let me ask questions without ever questioning my identity, which is exactly what I needed at the time. All too often in media, we see trans women portrayed as men pretending to be women, but ultimately the opposite is far more accurate. As a trans woman, I wasn't pretending to be female when I started presenting as female. I was learning to drop a carefully rehearsed act, and that was part of what was so tough. In previous chapters in this book, I've talked about how learning to survive autism symptoms was performative. I made flowcharts, I assessed actions and likely outcomes, I presented a version of myself that could get through the world unharmed. Well, that's also what I was doing with regards to gendered presentation prior to transition. I learned that holding myself in a certain way, making my voice sound a certain way, not acting in certain ways, could prevent me getting harassed. I spent years methodically pretending to be a man, only to come out and, with the right group of friends, just let myself start to unwind and be more authentically myself. I had to learn a lot of performative femininity to avoid harassment and NHS gatekeeping, but ultimately I just relaxed and let myself be who I was. I ended up finding that the best way to find out who I wanted to be. As it turns out, the best way to learn to be who I was to just drop the facade and to let myself be myself unfiltered. The best friends I've ever had are the ones I can just be me with, whoever that is, and still be seen as the woman I am.